Welcome to the This Is Money podcast. I'm Simon Lambert, and you are listening to an extra special bonus edition of the podcast where we're going to discuss what people need to do before the tax year ends. The calendar days are flipping past, the clock is ticking, and if you're one of those organized people who's got everything sorted, well, then you're fine. But if you're not, like the rest of us, then you've only got a few weeks to go. And what makes things slightly harder this year is that Easter falls just before the end of the tax year. But fear not, we're going to explain exactly what you need to know and what you need to do. And I'm joined today by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct, who's going to help us out. Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's have a quick look overall to begin with. What are the important allowances that people need to know about? And why does the tax year end matter so much to them?
Yes, there's quite a lot of fuss about the end of the tax year. And sometimes I think we sound a bit like broken records in the financial industry. But it is actually really, really important because it's when the various tax allowances reset. And a very big part of investing and personal finances generally is keeping things tax efficient, so you get to keep more of your returns. And time and again, we see investors kind of fixating on the investment side of the equation without actually thinking enough about the tax efficiency side. So April 5th, end of the tax year, and that's the final day before those tax allowances and exemptions refresh. And as you say, some people might have these things in hand already, or they have an advisor to take care of things for them, but for others, it's the last opportunity really to get their ducks in a row. And lots of people do, as you say, leave things to the last minute, which is why I think we have that all that noise really around tax year end. And the main things to think about are your ISA allowance, contributing to your pensions, junior ISAs for children, and overall considering your tax position more generally. And it may be that you can do things between now and the end of the tax year to improve your position and make things that bit more efficient.
Now, in terms of people's tax positions, Rob, there is an element where the end of this tax year is more important perhaps than other years, because there is another tax rate on the way, isn't there, for investors in terms of capital gains tax and dividend tax. And if they don't act and they don't use their ISA allowance, you know, or their pension if they want to put it in, they could end up costing themselves quite a bit of money, couldn't they?
Yeah, it feels like this tax year, it really matters. We're in the midst of some big, big cuts to some important allowances, not just salami slicing of allowances, but some big chunks. And the first one to focus on is the dividend allowance, which is the amount in dividends from shares and other things such as funds that you can earn each tax year without paying tax. That is outside of ISAs and other things like pensions. So at the present time, that allowance is at £1,000. That's for the 2023-24 tax year. So if your dividend income is less than that in the tax, you don't need to worry. You don't need to pay any income tax on the amount, regardless of whether you're a basic rate or a high rate taxpayer or additional rate taxpayer. But the problem really is that that dividend allowance isn't very much. If you've got £20,000, say, in shares outside of ISAs and pensions, and that and those shares yield, say, 5% on average, you're then generating £1,000 worth of dividend income, and you're using up that entire allowance. And the problem really is that that allowance used to be much, much higher, and it's fallen to £1,000 and going down to £500 next tax year. It was, as recently as 2017-2018, as much as £5,000, so it's really a shadow of its former self. And I think a lot of people are going to be ending up paying tax on dividends where they just won't have done so before. So the allowance is going to be a tenth of what it was. So lots of investors with quite modest shareholdings are going to be caught in that tax net. And you know, how much tax are they going to be paying? Well, basic rate taxpayer, the dividend tax rate is 8.75%. There's not actually too much, but for a high rate taxpayer, if you're starting to get into high rates tax with your income and the dividends take you over into that, it's 33.75%. So you can quickly accumulate a large tax bill if you overstep this quite modest allowance, if you're a higher rate taxpayer or you're close to becoming a higher rate taxpayer. And the personal allowance as well, if you think, okay, well, I'm not a taxpayer, I don't pay income tax because my income is so low, and I've got a little bit of dividend income, and that shouldn't tip the balance, you might still have to think about it, because the personal allowance, which is the slice of overall income that you don't pay tax on before you start becoming a taxpayer, is £12,570, and that's been frozen for several years now, and it's frozen again next tax year. 2019, 2020, it was £12,500. So it's only £70 higher than it was a few tax years ago. So even people who are non-taxpayers need to think about the fiscal drag that's going on with these allowances, because it used to be the case that they kind of ratcheted up each year with inflation or thereabouts. But we've been in a situation where their allowances are now either frozen, as with the personal allowance, or cut with the dividend allowance. So adding all that up, there's a lot of implications for people who hold shares outside of ISAs, and also for self-employed individuals who pay themselves partly via dividends from their own companies as well.
It's astonishing to think, isn't it, how much that dividend allowance has been cut by, from £5,000 not that long ago to £2,000, and then taken down from £2,000 to £1,000 to £500, at the same time, as you say, as those thresholds have been frozen, which drags more people into tax and also drags more people into higher rates of tax. And I think one thing that people need to think about as well is, if they're caught in any of the tax traps, like the removal of the personal allowance or the child benefit tax trap, then those dividends are added to their income, and it can make things even worse. But another place where investors have felt the heat is on capital gains, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It feels like a bit of a pincer movement on holders of ordinary investments outside of the tax shelters such as ISAs. With the capital gains tax allowance, you know, you've got a similar kind of reduction, and it's actually £6,000, your capital gains tax allowance, this 2023-24 tax year, and that's set to fall to just £3,000 from April. And that was as much as £12,300 just a couple of years ago. So again, you've had a great big chunk taken out of the amount of allowance that you've got. And that's the CGT allowance, capital gains tax allowance, is basically the amount each tax year that you can earn in terms of realizing profits from your investments tax-free. So you do get an annual amount, but again, it's sort of vanishing. And, you know, £3,000 from next April is pretty small. And above that, you'll be paying 10% at basic rate or 20% at higher rate for things like funds and shares. For second properties, it's a bit more. It's 18% and, well, was 28% for this tax year. And that's actually changed, been tweaked in the budget to 24%. But, you know, whatever you're realizing in terms of your investments and other assets that aren't protected by tax shelters, you're quickly going to be having to work out whether you're knocking on the door of declaring that and paying tax on it.
That's a good point as well, actually, because it's not just the tax on it. It's the headache of having to declare it and put it into your tax return, to have to work out your capital gains. And people think, oh, well, that's relatively easy. It's what I bought it for and what I sold it for. But people can often be surprised that they don't have the records of that they think, or also if they've got dividends that have been reinvested over the years, they've got to try and sit down and work out how much they bought each bit of their shareholding for. So in terms of ISAs, what do people need to do with their ISA, and why does that matter? I mean, obviously you've explained that there's this tax raid coming, but that removes the headache, doesn't it, if you get stuff into an ISA?
Yeah, and I think that's almost as important, because it's your time at the end of the day. And as you say, the calculations for working these things out, they can be simple, as you mentioned in the example where you just buy something and then you sell it. But increasingly, there's ifs, buts, and maybes in terms of, you know, adding to the position, or if you've, you know, if you're selling a second property that you happen to live in as well, there's some complicated stuff involved with that. So, you know, these calculations, when you're filling in tax returns, can get quite complex. So an ISA, and I know you can't put some, you know, things like property in it, but in terms of your investments, you know, keeping things in the ISA just keeps everything so clean and straightforward and simple. You know, there's no need to report income. There's no need to report interest or gains or anything like that to HMRC. So you're saving yourself a huge amount of time, as well as money in terms of tax potentially. So, you know, you might say to yourself, okay, well, I don't think I'd be paying tax on anything in the shorter term. I'm not too worried about it. But in the future, you might. And by using the allowance each tax year to the greatest extent you can, you keep more of your money outside of that sort of reporting regime. And that can, over the years, really do yourself a lot of good and save yourself a lot of hassle. So if you're over 18, you're UK resident, you've got that personal ISA allowance of £20,000 to use before the 5th of April each year. You can either use it for a cash ISA, which is just like a bank account with a tax shield around it, or you can have a stocks and shares ISA where you can buy shares, funds, investment trusts, and so on. Or you can have a mix of the two of them. And that really makes sense to try and use that as much as you can.
And in terms of getting your money into the ISA, can you just pay it in? You don't need to invest it before the start of the new tax year.
No, you can reserve the table, as it were. If you're looking at a stocks and shares ISA and you want to earmark that for investment, you can just put the money in as cash and then invest it at a later date. You know, we don't suggest you would hang on to that for too long, because generally your money is much better off invested for the long term rather than sitting in cash, if indeed it is for the longer term. But yeah, you don't have to make a decision on it right away. You can have a think about it.
And if people have got existing investments that they've just listened to all that and thought, oh God, I'm going to end up having to pay some capital gains tax when I sell those, or I think my dividends are going to be over the allowance, can they get those existing investments into an ISA?
Yes, sort of. The issue is that they would have to be sold and then repurchased in the ISA. So you can't lift them up and tip them into the ISA without actually selling them and rebuying them. That's what we call a bed and ISA. And of course, when you're selling them, then you will potentially trigger a capital gains tax liability. So it counts as a disposal in the same way of just selling them. However, you know, what some people will think about doing is using the slightly more generous capital gains tax allowance in this tax year to make that decision to move assets into the ISA by selling and repurchasing. And then you've got a £6,000 capital gains tax allowance when you're doing that, rather than next year when it's £3,000. And obviously over multiple tax years, you can migrate more assets into ISAs, which is generally a good practice. If you're not going to be using your ISA allowance with fresh money each tax year, then looking to your existing investments that are outside of ISAs, if there are any, and making those more tax efficient by migrating to ISAs makes an awful lot of sense. And I have seen, you know, portfolios of investments that clients have had where they haven't done that because no one has been advising them over the years, and they've just ended up with kind of loads of investments just outside of ISAs because they've just let them run. But it is good practice to really look at that and think about the tax side.
And your capital gains tax allowance is something that's gone once that tax year passes, isn't it? But there are different rules around if you make a loss on capital gains. How does that work?
Yeah, if you do make a loss, that can be carried forward. You do have to report that loss to HMRC. But where you do make a loss, you can report that, and that can be carried forward and set against future gains. So it's important that you do that as well. Again, a bit of a faff. It's got to be done via a tax return usually to do that. But it's certainly something that you should think about doing. Whenever you do sell something, then it's worth reporting it.
And that's the basics of ISAs covered off. Now we're going to move on to pensions, if that's okay. What do people need to know about pensions? What are the basics there, and how does the tax year end interact with them?
Yes. So with ISAs, you've got a kind of use it or lose it allowance. It doesn't carry on to the next tax year. And with pensions, it's kind of similar. There is actually some capability to carry forward some allowance, which I can go on to explain. But the major thing about pensions is that they're even more tax efficient than ISAs. So within ISAs, you don't pay capital gains tax, you don't pay income tax on any dividends or interest or anything like that. The same goes for pensions, but upfront they come with a big incentive of tax relief. So that's why it's important to sort of look at, you know, whether it's worthwhile topping up your pensions if you can before the end of the tax year, so you can shelter more of your money there. The tax relief, really, anyone who's under 75 with relevant UK earnings, so that's generally employed and self-employed earnings, can receive pension tax relief when they make a contribution. And really, that's HMRC adding 20%, or your pension provider claiming back 20% from HMRC, and any higher or additional rate tax relief can be reclaimed. So just by way of an example, if you've got, if an investor makes an £8,000 contribution into their pension, you'll get £2,000 claimed from HMRC by your pension provider. So that takes it to £10,000 invested. So you get an uplift effectively of 25%. We call it 20% tax relief because it's £2,000 out of the £10,000, but it's 25% uplift on what you've actually put in. And if you're a high rate taxpayer, you can get even more back. So a further 20% via your tax return, which takes the cost to as little as £6,000 for a £10,000 contribution. And it would just be £5,500 for an additional rate taxpayer if they've got sufficient earnings to do that. So that's why it's really tax efficient, a huge boost to your money right away. And that's really only going to come otherwise from either taking lots of risks or plenty of time in the market. So you know, there are downsides. You've got to lock your money away until retirement. And when you start to take the money out, you'll face tax when you do so. When you're actually taking benefits from your pension, you face income tax beyond generally the first 25% is tax-free.
And with pensions, we hear often about how paying some extra money into your pension can help with some of the tax traps that I mentioned earlier, where people end up with very high marginal rates due to things like child benefit being removed. That's obviously changed in the budget. It's changing from between 50 and 60 to 60 and 80, or having their personal allowance taken away above £100,000, which creates a 60% effective marginal tax rate for people. How does paying into your pension reduce what gets referred to as your adjusted net income and help you out here?
Yeah, that's right. So your adjusted net income is basically your total taxable income before any post-personal allowances. So if you make a pension contribution, you're effectively reducing that. And as you say, that can tip you below some of those important thresholds that you mentioned. So the high income child benefit charge is one of those, and the personal tax thresholds as well. And what you're effectively doing is reducing your income. It kind of works in two different ways. So if you have what they call a net pay arrangement with your employer in your workplace pension or something like that, it's also called salary sacrifice sometimes, is that your income gets reduced directly if you're, and effectively you divert some of your earnings into your pension scheme. So what you see on your P60 is a lower amount and the rest of it's gone into your pension. Or you can make a contribution and claim the tax back. So pension company, as I mentioned, claims sort of 20% tax back in terms of basic rate, and it's up to you to reclaim the rest. But either way, then the effect of all of that is to reduce that adjusted net income and to tip you below potentially some of those important thresholds. And certainly where you've got the bit between 100,000 and 125,000 odd, where your marginal rate is at 60%, which is obviously punitive. The Chancellor didn't look at that in the budget. It did look at the child benefit charge, but nothing is changing on that that difference between 100,000 and where additional rate tax kicks in. So, you know, you can make strategic pension contributions around those figures where that's relevant to you.
Although it does always amuse me when we talk about this and just imagine that people just have the odd, you know, £5,000, £10,000 sitting around that they can just push into their pension. People listening will go, yeah, but I don't have that money. I need that money. But I guess that's somewhere where you can think about maybe, I was going to say shuffling the deck chairs, but I shouldn't say shuffling the deck chairs, shuffling the cards differently in terms of if you do have some of those investments sitting outside of an ISA that you were talking about, or maybe you've got lots of investments in your ISA, or you've got a bigger pot of cash savings than you think you can have, you can maybe start moving some of that money around rather than just going, oh, well, actually, I don't have an extra £5,000 of income I can shove in there.
Yeah, and these are the sort of strategic decisions that a financial planner can help you with if you're not comfortable doing those judgment calls yourself, because you know it can get complicated pretty quickly and there can be different permutations of ways that you can do things. But yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people will say, okay, well, I actually need that income. Do you know what I mean? I can't really afford not to have that. The cost of living has risen and I don't have any cash to spare to make these contributions. But where there's husband and wife, where you've got different assets, and as you say, where there's assets held in slightly different places, there's a need to just kind of look at holistically at the whole picture and say, okay, well, actually, strategically, what can I do to reduce that tax burden and make it better for me going forward, not just for, you know, one tax year, but 3, 4, 5 tax years forever.
And when you look at these things with ISAs, pensions, and the end of the tax year, are there any traps that you think people are likely to fall into and they need to avoid? What are the mistakes that people might commonly make?
Yeah, I think with planning, there's always going to be traps. We've got such a complicated tax system. It really isn't all plain sailing. So despite there being sort of a sort of cast of thousands when it comes to different ISAs, I think they're generally fairly well understood. So I think probably the big things to watch out for is kind of your pension contributions where tax relief is restricted. So tax relief is limited into two things. One is 100% of your relevant UK earnings. So essentially that's earned income, not passive income, such as dividends or interest. Some people think it's on everything. It's not, it's just on earned income. Plus your overall allowance, including what's paid in by your employer, is also subject to an annual allowance, which is £60,000 a year presently. It used to be 40,000, 60,000 this tax year. So in terms of getting tax relief, you can't go over that amount. So that's one limit to think about. But if you happen to be a higher earner, you can get a lower allowance. This won't be a problem for people whose earnings are less than £200,000 a year. So the majority of people don't have to worry about it. But there is something called the tapered annual allowance, which reduces the amount that you can contribute to a pension. And also, if you've started taking retirement benefits via pension drawdown, then you do also get a lower allowance as well. So this is going to affect people who have maybe sort of started taking their pension and then thought to themselves, okay, actually, I kind of want to go back to work a bit more and then top up my pension. Well, if you started taking benefits and you've taken cash, say, beyond the first 25% of your pension pot, then you'll have an annual allowance too. Even if you're earning quite a lot of money, you'll have a lower annual allowance of £10,000 as well. So that's another thing to think about.
I think that any of those people who are earning more than £200,000 a year that you just mentioned there, and we're all for people doing things themselves on This Is Money podcast and at This Is Money, but I think those people probably do need to get themselves a financial planner rather than be doing it themselves.
I couldn't agree more. but you'd be surprised. There's a lot of people out there who do sort of think, okay, well, I'll crack on and I'll find out and I'll do it. But, you know, the rules are quite complicated to keep up with. And if you're in any doubt, absolutely get some qualified financial advice on it, because you don't want to be making a mistake with regard to it.
Now, in terms of investing, where you do have quite a lot more time on your side and also a much lower allowance, so less room for such expensive mistakes, investing for children, we've got the junior ISA as well, don't we? What are the rules on that? And what should people do about junior ISAs if they're investing for their children or their grandchildren, for example?
Yeah, so a junior ISA has many of the same features as an adult ISA. So there's no income tax to pay, no capital gains tax to worry about. So the cash or the investments inside the ISA can grow. without any of those tax considerations. So that makes it relatively hassle-free. The difference really is that the money is for the child and it's there until age 18 when it effectively becomes theirs. Actually, what happens is it becomes an adult ISA at that point and the child can withdraw the money. So if you're using a junior ISA, you need to be very sure that you're giving that money completely away to your child and that they'll be able to use that and have access to it, you know, no questions asked at 18. So that's the first thing. You know, the limit is a bit lower. It's £20,000 for an adult ISA. It's £9,000 for a junior ISA. But you've got, you know, potentially 18 years of that allowance. If indeed it stays at that, hopefully it might rise over the years. £9,000 at the moment. You've obviously got a very long time horizon. So my inclination with a junior ISA is always to consider stocks and shares junior ISA. You can have cash. We can have a mix of the two. But stocks and shares seems the natural fit because, you know, if you've got a long period of time until it's being used, whether it is for school fees or whether it's or university costs rather, or a deposit on a house or something like that, you know, you've got a very long period of time, very long runway for that money to grow, so you can absorb the volatility of the stock market over that period of time, and really look to the stock market for much better returns. The other thing to think about is, you know, it's not just the parent that can contribute to the junior ISA. It requires a parent or legal guardian to set up the account, but anyone else can actually contribute. So friends, family, relatives can also top it up as well, up to that £9,000 limit each tax year.
And we're not going to go too far into this because it's more a podcast about what you need to do in terms of before the tax year end. But you talked there about investments and stocks and shares. And one of the things that I think holds a lot of people back is the choosing investments bit. They can get over the hurdle of, okay, I can open an account, I can pay the money in. But then they hit the next hurdle of, I've got to choose what to invest it in. And I don't think, from all the conversations I've had over the years, that is necessarily because people are worried about picking the absolute best investments. It's because they're worried about picking bad ones or ones that go wrong. So for listeners who are thinking, right, I want to start investing in an ISA, or I want to start investing in a junior ISA or something like that, what are the easy options? What would be your suggestions for how to get started easily and what people need to think about in terms of choosing the right investments for them?
Yeah, so I think I've got two answers to that question. And one is as plain vanilla investment as you can get, but it will get you invested and it will get you diversified across the entire global stock markets would be what we call a tracker fund or a passive investment that basically follows the entire universe of global stocks. So what I'm talking about is a global index tracker fund, and they're widely available from platforms and within, you know, virtually every kind of a investment account that you could find. So if you're owning the entire global stock market or close to it within a global fund, you're like that, you're very, very diversified. You know, that's a great starting point. And as you continue through an investment journey and you learn more, you might want to sort of bolt on other things to that. But that could always be a part of your portfolio going forward, no matter what happens, provided, you know, you've got enough time and you're happy with the volatility of stock markets generally. Less time than 5 to 10 years, you'd probably think twice about putting everything in stocks and shares. But if it's longer than that, then, you know, that is the absolute go-to. Either for a core of a portfolio or for just someone starting out as their first building block. So the second thing would be, okay, well, I want to diversify more than that. I want to own more than just stock markets, and I want some balancing assets to cut out the volatility. So that might be more relevant to someone who, you know, perhaps their time horizon is a little shorter, or they're generally just not comfortable with the ups and downs that the stock market will inevitably give them. And there you could look at things like multi-asset funds, which is kind of what we call a one-stop shop, really. And the idea being that you actually have a diverse portfolio of shares, other things such as bonds and property and other assets all wrapped up in one product. And that will actually give you an even more diversified portfolio there'd be a manager who's deciding on the composition of that and rebalancing it as it goes along. And that will give you effectively a managed product in a single fund. Now, you'll be able to decide sort of different levels of risk for that. So there'll be some which are more tilted towards the stock market. They may even have sort of almost all of it invested in the stock market. And then there'll be some which are much more cautious that will have, you know, say 40% or 30% in the stock market. And it's mostly in other sort of lower risk and balancing areas. So you need to be really careful about which one you choose. But fortunately, there are, you know, we have our own range at Charles Stanley. There are sort of different flavors of the same thing for the different risk tolerances that people have. And, you know, that's a really easy way as well to get started and just have a simple product that gets you going.
And finally, before we end, on that note, if people are thinking about going a bit off-piste with some of their investments, they're saying, okay, well, that sounds great. And I like that sensible answer, but I also fancy picking up some things I'm interested in. I keep reading about AI. I'm interested in AI or something like that. What do they need to watch out for there once they start going down the route of choosing things that are much more specialized?
Yeah, I think that's quite common. People, you know, do like to have a little bit of something interesting in their portfolio. Let's face it, it can be a little dull if you just have the sorts of investments that I've just been talking about. What some people can do is have a kind of core, which is, you know, in the kind of more mainstream investments that I've been talking about, and then have little satellite holdings around that to kind of personalize things and add some interest. Yeah, the danger is obviously getting carried away with a particular theme and, you know, having everything in, you know, geared towards AI or a particular sector that's particularly in vogue, because investment does tend to go in cycles. There's lots of euphoria around something all of a sudden, and then, you know, before you know it, you've bought in at, you know, very, very high valuations, and that sector then goes on to do badly. So it's important not to have things that are just satellites. You know, you've just got to have a kind of sensible core before you add those. But what I would say is get a good compromise between keeping things simple and, you know, having a portfolio that's well diversified. So my analogy that I go to is kind of a Christmas tree, where, you know, you want sort of clusters of kind of complementary areas, but not too much or too little of one thing. And you definitely don't want to throw absolutely everything at it. It can be daunting, all the choice that's out there with different investments. There's thousands and thousands of different funds that you can choose from. But actually, you don't need a stamp collection. What you do need is kind of a sensible array of different things that kind of make sense in a coherent way. And if you are choosing your own one, we've got our own preferred list of funds that have been researched. We highlight as good quality options for new investment. You know, others will have the same things as well. So you're not alone in terms of kind of populating certain areas. But what I would suggest is having kind of a framework and a sort of portfolio construction that's in mind before you start populating it. Otherwise, you kind of add to it sort of ad hoc, you know, maybe by tax year, and then you end up with a sort of incoherent array of different things that you've kind of built up on a whim.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Rob Morgan's memorable tip for sorting your investments at the end of the tax year: think about Christmas at Easter. That's a good one. That's an easy one to remember, Rob.
Yeah, I should have saved that one for the Christmas podcast, but it's come out a bit early.
It's much more memorable if you do it now, to be perfectly honest. That's all we've got time for. Thank you very much for going through all of that and for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks very much, Simon. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Good luck. And remember, don't leave it to the last minute. Goodbye.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost-effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.